as the workforce is going to change. We see a lot more Gen Z. We see the, you know, the younger millennials coming in, and I can't remember what behind Gen Z is. But they have a different way of seeing things, but that doesn't mean they have a wrong way of seeing things. Like, you know, you hear a lot of this generational, you know, biting at each other. At least the media likes to portray it that way. Really what it bottom lines to, and I think it's something that you can take through all of it, is people want to be respected. They want to be listened to and heard, you know, and they want a seat at the table. I mean, who doesn't?
This episode is brought to you by Green Skies Analytics, an audit analytics service provider that works with internal audit departments that have data analysts and are still frustrated with trying to make analytics actually work, aren't getting the expected ROI, who can't break through the communication barrier between the analysts and the audit team, and those that need experienced direction for an audit analytics strategy and process. Those that feel like they've wasted time and money on trainings, aren't getting the value they want, not prioritizing the highest risk areas for the organizations, or have projects that seemingly never get completed. Do you deal with any of that? If you do, go to the show notes of this episode and click the Green Skies Analytics link, or go to greenskiesanalytics.com to schedule a call and understand how Green Skies Analytics makes analytics actually work for internal audit.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Audit Podcast. I'm your host, Trent Russell, and today we have Melissa Peachy on the show. She is the Senior IT Audit Manager at Cineverse. And the overall kind of theme for this one was the next gen auditor. So we talk about how to find the next gen auditor if you're looking to hire those, how to develop the next gen auditor if you have those folks on your team that you do need to make the next gen auditor. We talk about how to do that, as well as we always talk about, it seems like, the staff and senior type folks, and like, how do we develop these people and turn them into the next gen auditor and upskill them in this thing? We don't really talk about that with managers, though. And so Melissa made sure she wanted to hit on, okay, that's great, we fit the staff and senior folks. Now, how do we do the same with manager level folks in the audit department? So we also hit on that. And then for those that are interested, if you're in Agile and you're trying to maybe switch things up a little bit, they have a different approach on Melissa's team with doing their daily stand-ups. And so that might be something, a good takeaway to kind of experiment with and how they do it, their protocol and their approach. And then lastly, of course, we talked about pet adoption advice. Here we go. All right, Melissa, then what is in your either your internet browsing history as of late or your ChatGPT history as of late? It could be personal, could be work-related, whatever you want, wherever you want to go.
Yeah, considering I sit at my computer, I think, almost all day long doing things between schoolwork, whatever I'm doing personally, and work, I would say it's definitely an interesting mix. The biggest thing right now, which is probably the biggest thing on everybody's, is artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a couple of presentations there, but also making sure that I have the right information on how to break it down. I'm also in the middle of a digital forensics class, so I am in the process of just doing additional reading when it comes to that. I'm usually catching up on like what's going on in fashion, what's the latest movies that are out, anything new that I need to know about my dogs. I have two of them. I have French bulldogs, so I'm always, you know, looking for additional information on their food. I'm trying to think what else is in there. That's a lot of it. Now, when it comes to ChatGPT, so I actually am not using that personally, but I am using Bing Chat, which is pretty much the same thing. And a lot of that is having it help write things like an abstract for a presentation, or I'm looking for key points on, you know, a meeting I'm about to go into, and you know, give me ideas for 5 key points on X of whatever it is. I actually asked Bing Chat about artificial intelligence. Tell me about what you do. You know, it's interesting to see what kind of comments come back on that, to see what it is. And just kind of poking around. Like I said, I'm trying to think. I am going to North Carolina later this year, so it's been that research, going to Alaska next year, so that research. So it's a mix of all sorts of different things.
And we were talking travel before we hit the record button, more global travel, but so this has literally nothing to do with the podcast at all, but I read this somewhere and I think it's very true. And we were talking about even, like, I like doing all the research on the history of where we're going. Yep. And like, hey, let's go look at this thing. And if, you know, that brick were to fall out of place, then all of Western democracy would have never happened. You know, whatever, stuff like yeah. that. It was super interesting. But I've read that there is more almost enjoyment in planning the trip than there is on being on the trip.
So I think that depends on the trip. So I am a planner. I am the person who 18 to 24 months out, I am starting to look at, you know, where do we want to go? What are we going to do? Exactly how everything's going to line up. I actually start planning my wardrobe. Yeah. Is there anything I need to get? My mother and all my whole family is like, you and your plans. Like, I could probably be a professional itinerary planner because that's what I printed out. And the big thing is for me is like, everybody's like, oh, you know, we can't be that hemmed in. I'm like, no. You start with a plan and know that it's going to at some point deviate. But being the oldest of eight kids, if you left the house without a plan, good luck. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? 3 hours later, you've done nothing. So at least with a plan, you always have something to go back to. But I've had a few trips where it was so much fun planning. And then I get there and I'm like, oh, either sometimes the area wasn't as good as like it made out online, or something's happened. But yeah, I'm one of those people that gets really, you know, jazzed up about being able to plan something.
Yeah, the planning and not knowing, like, what do you want to do? I don't care. Where do you want to go? I don't care. I thought about naming a restaurant. I don't care. So whenever somebody's like, where do you want to go? They go, I don't care.
Sweet. That's right there. Yeah,
you need a
menu item, the same thing. What do you want? I don't know. Great. There's it right there.
There's one thing on the menu and it's called I don't know.
Yeah. It'd be great to do something like that.
Perfect. All right. And I think this will probably segue into the overall conversation also, but I am curious what you, the team, the audit team, et cetera, are doing out there relative to analytics.
So I actually just finished almost 2 years of a data science course. I decided not to actually finish the degree because I am not a mathematician. When they were like, yeah, you need to take pre-calc, I went, nope, we're done. I was like, thanks. I got to pick up R. I got to pick up Python. I got to pick up a lot of things about data visualizations, and really, especially my VP and what we're trying to do in our team is to drive value-added content for our executive team and our board of directors. And so what we're looking at doing is adding those analytics in there. Instead of just saying we noted X, you know, we're driving a lot more down into it and saying, okay, you know, X out of a number of population, and we saw this skewing one direction or another, or what was our distribution on it. So really getting more analytical about how we present things so that when you have those visuals, it's got more impact and more punch. So there's a lot of things that we're trying with that. I'm usually the one that's the champion in the group to try new things, and I'm the one modeling it. And then once I do that, we roll it down to the more junior staff. But yeah, that's that. We're bringing it in quite a bit because there's just too much value there to leave on the floor by not doing it.
Okay. And then you mentioned data science and the math that you would have to take to get there. And I do like to dispel this myth. So there are data scientists and there's data analysts.
Analysts, right.
Data scientists, yes, math heavy, you know, PhD statisticians, et cetera, very stats heavy. That's data scientists. Data analysts, not so much.
Maybe agreed.
Standard deviation. And if I lost some people there, it's super easy. Once you kind of get in there and understand it and look at examples and go, oh, now that makes sense because I'm not in my stats class.
Yes. So standard deviations, your Z-scores, your things along those lines, which is the less intensive. That I was cool with. Like, and I was actually, I was even impressed with myself. I'm like, wow, you know, after being in business for so long, I'm like, man, I know these a lot better than what I did. And I remember sitting in a presentation that I think it was more financial driven, whereas I intend to be the IT side of the house. And they had all this stuff up there. And I'm like, I actually understand all of this stuff. I know what all of it is. So it was great. But to finish the degree, they were pushing more to the data scientist side. And I was like, no. I needed the analyst side of things. So I got what I needed out of it. I love taking college courses instead of necessarily sometimes going to conferences, especially at the local college level, which is going to actually lead right into what I'm going to talk about in a little bit. At the local college level, it's, you know, about $300 to take a 3-credit course, and I'm actually learning hands-on information that I can do. That's why I'm taking, well, now I'm working on my cybersecurity degree, because if I'm going to do the classes, I may as well get the degree too.
Sure.
But I get 15 CPE out of it. So when you're looking at the return on investment, it's huge. And so anytime my guys are asking like, well, what do we do for CPEs? I'm like, look, go find a topic. Maybe it's you want to dig further into operating system security, or you want to do something else. Go to your local college. Grab a $300 class, you know, 15 CPE. We're supposed to have, I think, 40 a year for our certifications. And now you've gained a valuable skill and you've managed to get CPE all in one shot. And so I think it's a great way of doing that. I've been doing it that way for years.
Very good, solid, actionable, practical advice.
And I don't think a lot of people think to do it.
Yeah.
No, they're always looking out, you know, the conferences, and those are great. But every time I go to a conference, I'm like, okay, but most of the time I could probably give the presentation. I haven't learned anything new. And I've a lot of feedback I've gotten from my different ones is we want takeaways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always try to make sure the presentations I'm doing are doing that. I want to be able to sit down after what I just heard and go implement something, you know, that I picked up from doing that. If you're just talking information at me, I can do that sitting in front of a Google. You know, that's it. That's easy enough. Give me something and an insight that maybe I hadn't thought about. And I think that's why, you know, a practical class is just sometimes better than just a presentation.
And so I'm going to plug this. We haven't made this announcement yet, but this will be the first. So every year we have hosted the Audit Analytics Conference. 2 days, usually 16-ish CPE, and it's 90% practitioner-led. And so we very rarely get vendors and contractors and the like. It's very much, nope, I am the practitioner. I do this for my organization, and then this is how I do it. And so that's what we always ask all the speakers that present is, nope, you have to show us how to do it. I can go find somebody from wherever to tell you why it's important. We all know that by now. The mission is you show people how to actually do it. So this is year four of that. Again, just as the, I guess this is going to be the official announcement. Sorry, Melissa, to hog this part. But
I think that's fantastic. I mean, I think it's something, again, if audit teams aren't thinking of doing this or haven't been doing it yet, what a great way to get started, because the analytics definitely, they jazz up those reports.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that both the executive teams and the board of directors can actually sink their teeth into. It's not just, a prose dialogue of what we saw.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, why? Well, when you can see, exactly what the issue is in a given data visualization, it's much more impactful.
Absolutely.
So I think that's fantastic.
So September 25th and 26th, for those that are interested, go ahead and block your calendar out. Block your calendar off, and then you'll get we'll make the announcements formalized and when registration's open and all that. But if anybody wants to go ahead and block their calendar, September 25th, 26th is the date for this year. Okay, well, that's it. So you're talking, I think, that brilliant way of getting CPE, local college, all that kind of stuff, and you're very much a learner with the way you're describing with cybersecurity and the data science understanding that you've gained from those local courses. And I know the topic that you wanted to hit on when we first met was the next gen auditor. And so what should we be looking for? And we've talked about this a little bit in the past, and it's definitely been a hot topic. It feels like, well, for a very long time, but even more so since 2020. What are you looking for? So those people that are like, yep, we need to hire the next gen auditor. Also, what is that? Who is the next gen auditor? What's the background? What's it look like?
So I'm going to segue a little bit just to explain my background, which is why what I look for is a little bit different. When I started in auditing almost 19 years ago now, I was actually an executive assistant. I understood processes and controls, not that I knew that that's what they were really called, but I did. And when Sarbanes-Oxley came about at the company that I was with, they were saying, hey, do you want to take this over and document everything? Great. The auditors there went, where'd you go to school for auditing? And I'm like, I don't do taxes. They're like, no, that's not the kind of auditor we're talking about. Didn't even know the profession existed. And so left the contract there, ended up at Centerverse. And as I was going through and doing the work, one of the VPs there said, you know what? You have skills that we can't train. And then we're willing to train you if you're willing to take it on. And here I am 19 years later. Had no credentials at the time. Now I have one I'm very proud of, my bachelor's and my master's that I earned while going, while working with them. And so a lot of what I'm looking for is three things, which is not the easiest to always identify, but I'm looking for passion, curiosity, and drive. Because with those three things, if they're curious, they're going to learn. If they've got a passion for doing something, and the drive to do it, they're going to get there. So I'm looking for those one-offs. It's not always the what you're going to find in an HR algorithm. Interestingly enough, I got inadvertently invited to a talent acquisition networking dinner the other day. They were like, yeah, we didn't really mean for you to be here, but since you're here, let's talk. And now they're like, yeah, you need to come back more. Because one of the things that they're looking for is what is management needing? And it's not always a degree. And that's not to say that the degree is not important. I earned mine after the fact, but I think we put so much emphasis on it that when you get someone who is textbook smart. And in fact, somebody said this the other day. They're like, I go to school to learn about the subject. I go to work to learn how to do the subject. That's a big telling statement right there, that it's like, okay, I'm not getting somebody trained out of the gate. And if they're like, okay, well, I went to school for this, therefore I'm going to do this job. Here I am. Like, okay. And they can be very prescriptive in what they do. And what we really need, I think, in the next gen auditors are the ones who are going to push the boundaries, the ones who are going to look to add that value, that are curious, that when they're handed something, it's not, well, this is what we did last year. Here, we're going to do it again this year. It's okay. And let me back up even more. When I first started, all I was doing was SOX controls. That's it. I wasn't doing anything operationally. But guys, isn't SOX controls just part of the business? I mean, that is operational stuff. So therefore, well, while I'm testing this, hey guys, tell me more about this process. Tell me what's going on. And if I saw a one-off on it, even if it didn't manage to actually be a SOX deviation or anything, and it was still important, I'd go back to my management and say, hey, while I was doing this, I also noticed this. That's what I need. That's what businesses need. We need somebody who's not going to say, look, just put me in my little box. Let me do what I'm doing. I'm going to clock in, clock out, and I'm done. That's fine. I'm not talking about the actual hours. What I'm talking about is during those hours, what value are you providing? And that's actually, I have two what I call isms, Melissa-isms for me. And that is, the first one is stay relevant. That's where my consistent learning always comes in. I watched people in various organizations that were there for years, and it's like, but what value are you continuing to add? And if you're not, then you're no longer relevant, which is easy to then end up on a chopping block for a cut. So stay relevant, and then value add. That goes two ways. Am I continuing to add value to the organization so I know this is a right place for me to stay? But in addition, is the organization continuing to add value to me? If that becomes out of balance, that's when you end up either, it's like, okay, well, it's probably time to leave. And the only reason I haven't left after 19 years is because that value has continued to stay in balance for me. So again, finding those people who are curious, it's the one-offs, they really want to do something different, which means I don't need somebody just straight out of college, or I need, my niece just started. She's actually a customer service specialist, kind of taking the back door in. And it's like, look, I can learn all this stuff over here and then transfer it to what I'm doing later. I could have somebody who's like, you know what, let's say I've been a system admin for 25 years and I want to do something different. Great. You know the systems. I can teach you how to audit. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a matter of broadening what we're looking for as far as next gen. Next gen can mean a lot of different things. It can be an older person looking to, you know, like I said, change their career up. It can be somebody young who's completely starting out. It's finding those three things is the key. And so I think what we were going to talk about next was how.
That's my follow-up is passion, curiosity, drive. And curiosity is one as an analyst that I look for. Because if not, to be curious is to go figure out a new way to do something, try to make it better, see something in the data and go, well, that looks funny. Let me just go take a look and see what that is real quick. But then also having the discipline to not go down these huge rabbit holes all
rabbit
the time.
Rabbit holes.
You have to have the objective at the top. But
right.
So, and maybe we could break down these individually if that makes sense. But passion, curiosity, drive, how do you tease those out? If you were interviewing a candidate, how do you go, passion, yep, check, 10 out of 10. Drive, 8 out of 10. Curiosity, 6 out of 10 or something, you know, whatever it is. I don't expect you to have a scale like that necessarily, but how do you determine that the folks that you're interviewing or considering have those skills?
So I think a lot of it too is to break out of the typical questions that you would ask during an interview. You still want to ask, you know, what was your last job? What are the things you did? But I also want to look at things like, I'll ask them things like, what kind of, are you into music? Are you into entertainment? Anything like that? Because usually somebody who is curious, they're going to be I'm into a lot of different things. Or they'll be like, you know, hey, I started, you know, maybe I was looking at something at work and it sparked my interest. And so I did this, you know, what kind of research do you do? You know, ask them when you're getting ready to audit something new or start something new. Do you do any research ahead of time? If they're like, no, I just pretty much deal with it when I get there. Well, you can tell that curiosity is not there. Curiosity drives people. And it can be on anything. I am a research nut. I think part of it is my dad instilled in me. It was like, if you didn't know something, go look it up. He wouldn't even discuss a topic with you unless you looked it up first. So I got so used to always looking things up that even if I'm sitting and watching a TV show and or a movie and they say something about a topic or a word that I'm like, what is that? You know, I'm immediately looking things up to be like, oh, okay. Don't know that I'll ever need that knowledge, but I want that. So I think there's a way to kind of suss that out of the or get that out of the personality. Typically, they're not always going to be, I mean, big personalities like I am. Some of them might be quieter. And it's a matter of asking, I think, more case specific, like give me an example of what you did when you were given, you know, a specific control to test. How did you test that? And did you, you know, find anything else coming out of that? The people that are curious and driven, they're going to share those details, I think. If they don't, then, you know, when you're looking for an entry-level staff, that's a little bit harder. And that one is a little bit more trial and error because they haven't been out there yet. But again, that's where I think some of the HR, you know, approved personal questions can come in as far as that goes. It's just asking, you know, what are their interests? And I think you can kind of get an idea when it comes to those things.
All right. So between those three, let's say you're 2 out of 3 and you're just crushing it and you look at it and go, okay, I can maybe teach you X, Y, Z, or I can coach you on this. Like, how do we build those competencies for the staff that maybe don't have those? In hiring, it's one thing because you can kind of screen those to begin with. But if you're like, no, this is the team I've got and I need to develop these competencies, how are you able to do that?
I think the first thing is to level set expectations that it is required to be able to continually learn. That if all they're doing is, you know, phoning in their CPEs, they're grabbing those, you know, free CPEs that you can get that are an hour long, you know, the ones that people tend to put on the side and listen to while they're still working. If they're not actively growing themselves, that's one of those things. It's a level set expectation of, I expect to see that. If you're about to go into an audit, like, I'm going to give you a week before we get started. I want to see what kind of research. I mean, some of it is doing, I think, almost the same thing my dad did to me, which is, okay, hey, we're going to go do this. I want to see what you come to the table with. If they consistently come to the table and they're like, oh yeah, here's this one article. Like, eventually you're going to start to see that there's a performance issue there. And it's going to be a question of, not so much, and let me back up. I don't like to be a boss. I always tell my guys, I want to be a mentor, a coach, a leader. I'd be a boss if I have to be. But really, I'm here to help you guys be successful. So I'm going to do everything I can. But after a while, you can kind of start going, hey, guys, is this really what you want to be doing? Like, I know, you know, it's scary to think that, man, I don't really want to jump at a job. But if you don't really want to be here, then I'm not really getting what I need in this position. And so sometimes I think those you know, conversations have to be had. And it's not that that person is lacking anything. It's just that maybe they're not in the right job fit. So I think that's the big thing, is being very transparent and honest with the team of, these are the expectations. This is what I want to see. And people are either going to pick it up and run with it, or they're going to be like, maybe not. And again, that doesn't mean they're automatically out. Sometimes you want to repurpose what they're doing, or maybe they're great at, you know, doing just actually kicking work out and they perform consistently. They're just not the research person. Okay, well, now I'm going to work with each person individually to figure out what they do best, especially like you said, when you've been handed a team. I'm going to do everything I can to help them be successful and try to teach them. You'll know when it comes to a point when it's like, okay, maybe this just doesn't work at all. But I think it's, you know, it's a big puzzle piece. Or actually the analogy I'll use is back when I used to do theater. And, you know, you'd have auditions because we're going to do a musical. Okay, well, I've got all these different parts that people need to play. And what you're trying to get in a cast is a balanced cast. If you get one person who's really amazing and everybody else is slightly below that, it's an imbalanced cast. So you're not always going to be casting the best person in the room. You're casting what's going to create the best ensemble. And that's really what you're doing even with your team, is you're looking at the best way to balance your ensemble of a cast who is your teammates.
Okay. Two questions. On the theater side, sing something.
Oh, you would ask me that when I've had a sinus infection for like 3 days, not to mention to warn you before you actually ask that, is that I am a belter.
Okay.
So let's see. What is a good one to... Oh, so this is a funny one. This is, it comes from a show called The Life, which is, funny enough, about prostitutes on Times Square in the 80s. But there's a great one called Use What You Got. And it's, when you're a hustler, there is one thing you should know. You have to hustle every day. When you're a hustler, there's no time to take it slow. Gather ye suckers while you may. So.
First time we've had a song on the show. So breaking new ground here. Honestly, I didn't think you would do it. I thought you'd be like, no, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. It's one of those things I've had a couple of people ask me that when they hear that, they're like, at some point we have to get you. And I'm like, so I kind of keep them keyed up in the back. Like, what's one of the best ones?
Yeah. Nice.
And with this, I knew it had to be one of my lower register ones.
Yeah, right. All right. I think you crushed it. Okay, back to the topic, Ben.
Yeah.
So on, I put required learning and then setting the expectations. And as things go, regardless of if you have the passion, curiosity, drive, there is the day-to-day that happens and you go, hey, I know I'm supposed to be doing this, but I also have to issue this audit report and I have to kick this thing off and I got to start this thing and I've got this other thing that I got to do. How do you hold people accountable? And if there's specific initiative or something like that we could speak of, that'd be great. But the accountability factor, I think, is very important. And I know, like when you said, hey, go do the research, it's easy to hold them accountable when they come back and go, this is what I did or didn't do. That's, you know, a way to hold them accountable. But any other examples, I guess, you could give of, here's an initiative we launched. It was outside of the day-to-day audit work that we do. And this is how we were able to hold these people accountable and see that they actually hit that or reached that initiative.
I'll actually explain one of the things I actually ended up changing on my team this year, because we have a lot of things coming at us. I always equate it to like the tennis ball machine when you're, you know, practicing by yourself and somebody walked by and slammed the thing and all of a sudden you're like, what? You know, you got to be able to account for those things. So I think part of it starts with the very beginning of your audit plan of not over planning so much that you don't have any wiggle room in it. You have to know those one-offs are going to end up coming up. The other thing is I went back to, we kind of talked about earlier, I love the plan. And so I, one of my degrees is being project manager. And there are so many skills within project management that if you employ them right out of the gate and are consistent with them, they help with those things. So what my team and I do is I sat down and we set out the plan and we created 2-week sprints. So now we're working with an agile type methodology on top of project planning. We have calibration meetings at the end of every week, or if something new comes up and we look at, okay, what is actually planned for the next 2-week sprint? You know, are we planning ahead? One of our values at the company is think ahead, but move fast. And that's okay. Don't just look at your 2 weeks here. Look down here as well. Start setting your meetings and things. And then what happens is when something new comes up, then it's, we sit back down with the thing and say, okay, well, what can we push? What can we move around? Do we need to push something to somebody else? How do we fit that in? And then this is your deadline for, you know, hitting it. So it gets, anything one-off still gets handled the same way as a day-to-day, but it gets calibrated into the overall picture so that we don't lose sight of it. And so we've been doing that for, well, since the beginning of the year now, and it has fundamentally changed the way that the whole department runs. It's actually more seamless now. And that's something that I think everybody can learn, even if you're not doing the big, huge, all the project management stuff. But I think the smaller sprints, the weekly calibrations, biweekly with our VP, that smooths that out and still holds people accountable because we look to see it completed at some point.
Okay. And I think the 2-week sprint, I mean, there is plenty on the internet. If people aren't doing sprints, look into that. There's plenty of guidance on there, free stuff all over the place. Everybody has an opinion on it and the way they do it. And so pick and choose whatever works for you in that protocol, you should be fine. So I don't want you to necessarily speak to that. We've talked about agile sprints previous episodes.
Yep.
The calibration meeting is something a little different. And so walk us through that. So you have a 2-week sprint. So we're going to do this over the next 2 weeks.
Yep.
And then the next week you have your calibration meeting. What's on the agenda for that? How do you run that?
So actually every week. So every week we have a calibration meeting. And what it is usually the one. Okay. So you have the one before a 2-week sprint, and that's going to be looking at first. Okay. Did we finish everything in the sprint we were just in? Does anything need to pull over? If so, why is it pulling over? Was there a reason? And the big thing is don't tell me 2 weeks later that you had a problem at the beginning of the sprint that I should have known in between. But that's what that middle meeting is for. So the first thing is anything crossing over? And then what is on our sprint for the next week? we're looking at, is anybody going to be out? Like, you know, because that's when you're looking at, you know, anything with project management, three things: time, resources, or scope. So if my resource and my time is going down for a week because they're going on vacation, well, then their scope has to come down for that sprint. And so that's the before a sprint. In the middle of a sprint, then we're going and looking at, okay, are you having any problems with the things that you're assigned with? Are people not responding? Are you stuck on a concept or something that is not looking right? Are you potentially having an issue because maybe there's a deviation, but you're not sure? We're going to look at that. And the guys know that my team knows that they're to come to me, even if we don't have a calibration meeting. But that's a more formal one to say, okay, is everything going well for the first week? And then when we get to the second week, like I said, if you tell me in the second one something that you should have told me in the first one, then we have to have a talk offline of, guys, you can't wait. Because we've had it to where, especially like if for some reason an auditee is not responding, you could end up 6 weeks down the line. Well, guys, your due date was 3 weeks ago, you know, and it's not okay. Now I need to go talk to their management. So what we're doing is I'm trying to take everything and kind of pull it back this way, you know, and make it to where it's not so always brushing up against something, that we have enough space to be able to do the things that we need to do.
So it sounds like your calibration meetings that you hold weekly covers the same topics that are typically covered in a daily stand-up. Is that right? You've kind of replaced daily stand-ups with this weekly calibration meeting?
Yes. Part of the reason for that is I think sometimes, and a lot of companies are starting to look at this, how many meetings are people actually having? There's not a lot that changes, I think, day to day, or sometimes it can be, but I don't want to wait till the next morning to find out there's something. My team should know that, look, if there's something I need to talk about, ping me on Teams, send me an email, call me, whatever it is, when it's happening. I don't want to have to necessarily wait for it, but I also want them to have the ability to manage their own workloads. And so I think the weekly gives them enough space to do that. It gives management enough space to say, you know, we didn't give you a month of things and then find out there's an issue. But it's not so much getting into the level of micromanaging. And who needs one more meeting on their day? I mean, my schedule is usually packed from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. every single day. So, you know, it's easier just to touch base, you know, when needed. Mm-hmm. Versus we have to do this every single day. And I think that's the point of being agile. The idea is that you do what makes it work for you to be able to give the value and the return on whatever you're investing in. So if it's weekly, if it's maybe twice a week, whatever's going to work for you. It's just a matter of making sure you have the touch points and then also trusting your team to do their business.
I'm glad you hit on that. I just wanted to give people other options, basically. So I know for some, the stand-up does get stale to some degree for some folks. And so if that's the case and people are looking for other options, and I think this weekly calibration meeting might be something definitely worth experimenting with and going like, hey, this actually works better for us. All right, we have talked next-gen auditor a couple of times on the show, but something that nobody ever really talks about is a topic you mentioned is the next-gen manager. And I feel like there's some managers right now going, I don't want to do that. No, I'm just supposed to tell everybody else what they're supposed to do. I don't want to have to change and become the next gen manager. But what does that look like? What does the next gen manager look like?
So I think there's definitely different schools of thought for it. But I can tell you what it means for me to be a next gen manager. As the workforce is going to change, we see a lot more Gen Z. We see the younger millennials coming in. And I can't remember what behind Gen Z is. But they have a different way of seeing things, but that doesn't mean they have a wrong way of seeing things. Like, you know, you hear a lot of this generational, biting at each other. At least the media likes to portray it that way. Really what it bottom lines to, and I think it's something that you can take through all of it, is people want to be respected. They want to be listened to and heard, and they want a seat at the table. I mean, who doesn't? So I think it's a lot more collaborative. Again, I go back to when I told my team, I want to be a mentor and a coach and a leader, not a boss. I'll be a boss if I have to, which means if you're not performing and you're not, doing the things that you're supposed to be accountable for, I'm going to have to deal with those things. But I want to work with you up to that point. It's not simply I'm going to delegate everything to you and get it done and, don't bother me. Empathy is huge. And again, this isn't stuff that should even be talked about as a next gen manager. I think this is stuff that we talk about even now. I mean, who wouldn't want, leaders that are like this? Is that how do you inspire your workforce to do the things that they need to do while you also continue to inspire them? I follow, you may have heard of it, something called servant leadership. And it kind of, you know, it takes the manager here and puts him at the bottom. I'm here for my team. You know, if my team surpasses me before I move up, then great. I've been doing my job even better. And I think it's one of those things that the more you do that, the more everybody's helping everybody, everybody becomes successful. So I think we need to see more of that mindset. I've always talked about it. You know, if I'm thinking about you and you're thinking about you, well, then nobody's taking care of me. But if everybody's thinking about each other and doing what needs to be done, then everybody wins. And not everybody is, I think, you know, necessarily used to doing things that way. It's certainly not what we've seen, you know, throughout the years. And it's a shift. It's the, you know, and we could get into the whole, but some want to work from home. Those are all the different things. And the companies overall will have to figure those things out. Having learned most of my job from sitting in a chair next to somebody in an office, I absolutely understand the value of being in person. However, I also understand the value of being able to have the work-life balance and not having to spend 3 hours in commuting. And again, I'm going to go back to value. Where are you getting the most value? When we come into the office, we are very intentional about our days that we're in the office to say, okay, during this day, we're going to meet, we're going to collaborate, we're going to do all of those things that's better to do in person, and then not worry about that on the days when we're not. And I think it's a matter of just getting that clear and that guidance down. Be there for the people that are working for you, you know, help them through the things that they need to help through. And then in return, they're usually going to do what you need to do to be successful as well. So I think it's a lot more people focused, oddly enough, as we, you know, there's terms within the HR realm that I'm not a big fan of, but people is the focus of everything. I mean, go to the heart of anything of what makes something work, and it comes down to people. And the more a manager remembers that, the better and more successful I think their team will be.
And these are all questions really that I was curious about, and I felt like maybe the audience was also, especially in hiring and retention is always a big deal for pretty much everybody right now. But with that said, I do want to kind of give you the floor. Is there anything else that you want to leave the audience with, or if there's a thread you want to pull on a little bit more, that's absolutely fine too. But I would say the floor is yours.
Yeah, I think the big thing to remember is if everybody is pulling everybody else up, there's just so much more to be successful, you know, with. There was this clip on the internet I saw, and it was a team, I think it was like 7 people, and they ran up to this board, and the first 4 got underneath, and then the 3 climbed up them, and then they pushed them up, and then they turned around and pulled them up, and you watch this whole team go over like no time flat. But nowhere in any of that was there that I'm not helping that one, or I'm going to go over here and know I'm not. They all work together as a cohesive unit. So that's, I think, what we need just overall. Society wise and in jobs and in life, that's what you need. You need that team who's going to push and pull when it's the right time to do that. And if we're all doing that, then everybody wins. And I know it sounds cliche, but it's a matter of you've got to kind of get out of the me mindset that I am not the focus, that, you know, I'm here to help other people. I think that's the big thing. The more you do that, you're going to see a difference in how things work. Overall, I'm excited to keep expanding my career. I love doing things like this. So thank you for having me on as well. It's continuing to learn, continuing to pass that knowledge on. Hopefully it sparks somebody else. And in turn for that, actually, you guys can find me on LinkedIn. I am happy to do, I've done mentoring sessions. I've just done, hey, I have one thing I would love to pick your brain on. Do you mind if I set up a 30-minute call? Always happy to do that and give my time where I can. Because again, you know, I don't want to just keep all of this. You know, I learn a lot, and there's value in it for me, but there's so much more value if I get to share it. So I'm always happy to do that. And then Trent, I know we were talking about, you said some of your people have been asking about adopting pets. The only thing I will say about when it comes to animals in general, I have two, I have 2 French bulldogs that I adore. But if you are somebody who travels a lot, make sure you know you have somebody who can keep an eye on them, because it becomes astronomical in the price. The cruise I am looking at going on next year, in order for my dogs to be watched in the way that I would want them to be watched, it's like $2,000. So yeah, it's almost the same price as a cruise. So you're doubling your vacation. The cost of them is the one thing. Make sure you do your research on the breed. I go back to research. I did 6 months of research before I thought I wanted the Frenchies, but I wasn't sure. So I literally, it was like, here's the different breeds I like. Here's the different things on their temperament. I did data analytics, and said, okay, what's all the different things? And then I went out and found the reputable breeders and, you know, looked at, you know, was rescue the right for me? I mean, I did all of this analysis before I got them. My girl will be 13 actually next month. So she's starting to push up there. And then my little man will be 10. I love them, the pieces. I swear they eat better and get taken care of, you know, better than I do. but just be aware of all of that before you decide to get one, because what you get back, I would never trade it in the world. But I don't think everybody's always, you know, prepared for that. And the other thing I would say is, if you're not going to do pet insurance because it doesn't always pay out, start a savings account. Whatever you were going to pay for pet insurance, just put it in a savings account. If you never need it, great. You got a nice big savings account going. If you do need it, then it's there in case something happens. So that's what I'll say on the animal front.
Next gen auditors, ways of changing up sprint planning and stand ups, and then advice that I'm taking with, we don't do pet insurance, but we're definitely, the savings makes sense to put that away. So that is a takeaway, unexpected on my end, that I am definitely going to do.
Hey everyone, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Audit Podcast. Whatever platform you're listening on right now, I'm sure there's a subscribe button somewhere, so please hit the subscribe button there. If you're listening through iTunes or Spotify, feel free to go give us that 5-star rating. It only took me about 16 seconds to give myself a 5-star review, and it really helps to get future guests to come on the show, so we'd really appreciate that. Lastly, be sure to check out the show notes and follow us on all our social media channels, on Instagram, on LinkedIn, and on TikTok. Also, if interested, please sign up for our weekly newsletter from The Audit Podcast. Thank you all. Have a great one.